Welcome to Coaching with Catherine, the podcast on defining success on your own terms. My name is Catherine Levenhagen. Every Friday, you will get a new podcast on how to make life mean more and build a life you're proud to live. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Coaching with Catherine. Today, I'm super excited to introduce you to Phil Guymon. Phil is a retired American professional road cyclist, as well as a whole lot more. Phil is a writer, a blogger, a YouTuber, and a Strava record holder for KOMs, King of the Mountain Climbs. Let's dive in and talk to Phil now and learn more about how he defines success and how he's created success on his own terms. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show. Okay, so I think I want to start out by asking you, how do you define success?
I think it's probably a process, because I have a feeling that every time you find success, you want something more, slash fear of that. But I think overall, what I try to do is, when I feel successful is when I spend a day doing stuff that I want and nothing I don't. Like, it's easy to do things that you like, but if somebody makes you do something you don't want, that'll knock it down. So I think that's the process. Is gradually doing more of things you like and less of things you don't like.
Has your definition of success changed over your life, like as you would define it now?
Yeah. And that's why I sort of was vague and broad with my answer. For a long time, my idea of success was like the next rung in the pro cycling ladder. Is like, oh, when I do that, I'll be happy. Or when I go from this level pro team to this level, that'll solve all my problems. And I found that it didn't. And I found that I was at the highest level and not really satisfied or happy. And so since then I've been forced to redirect that. I don't know, so far so good. But I think those are sort of the days when I reflect on, like this morning I made a little video and I rode my bike for 4.5 hours with 2 friends. And so I had a few things that I had to do, and then I mostly did what I wanted to do. And I think there's definitely going to be a balance. I don't see myself ever being able to eliminate all of the things that equal job or things you're forced to do. But yeah, that's when I feel fulfilled and successful for 2/3 of today.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been intentional about creating what you want for the most part.
Kind of, yeah. I think I've been able to steer it. I don't know. I've been sort of following things that make sense and kind of responding to stuff. I wish I could say I planned anything, like seeing what people like and what works and paying attention and like trying to respond to it creatively has worked really. It's worked better than anything else I've ever done. My current chapter of YouTube bike riding.
Well, and it sounds like this is a new, like, you're saying current chapter, and it sounds like this is new for you. Kind of moving through your life, this is a little bit different than how you were up to when you retired.
Yeah, I would say like the background for people who don't know who the heck I am would be like I was a pro cyclist. I was trying to win the Tour de France kind of thing. Like I was never at that level, but I was kind of on those teams. And so I was just always chasing this thing, and pro cycling wasn't in a good, well, it's never been in a good place since I paid attention to it. There's the scandal, and there's kind of like an old guard. There was a lot to navigate aside from just like the physical ability I wasn't quite going to get to. So I kind of like being, I'm now 2 years or a year and a half removed from racing professionally. Like I feel like I spent a decade in a way, like I was really good at this thing, but in a way I feel like I was pounding myself into a hole that was a different size. I feel like I was trying to conform to a system that like weren't quite working for me. And ultimately, like when I gave up on that, I'd had enough other opportunities and I was good at enough other things that what I did was I brought a bunch of bike sponsors to a YouTube channel. So it's similar sponsors, but I'm in charge of, but basically like I'm creating and directing and editing. Or I have people who edit, but like controlling that process. So I had to kind of like reinvent myself, but it's still like I'm riding bikes, I'm doing what I want. This year, I can tell that it's working for the first time. Like that was going on. And it was a crossing fingers thing. And this year it's like, okay, I put up a video and 40,000 people watched it. So it's going to be okay.
What's different about this year?
Basically proof of concept. There wasn't really, no one was, the thing I was doing, I was making up as I went. And that went to, that included the sponsorship side of it, of just like, who am I going to get to pay for this? And so last year I kind of like, I went to sponsors that I had relationships with and I was kind of like, hey, I'm going to make a YouTube channel about me trying to get hill climb records in weird places. And will you pay me for that? And they were all like, well, there was no value for them at that point. But once people watched it and I did a good job making it and it had enough subscribers, enough views, I could be like, hey, when I posted your video, you know, 4,000 people clicked on the link at the bottom of it. So to go to your website. So that's probably worth something.
Ultimately, you could show them the value.
Yeah. And they, and most of them knew it already. And a few came in and kind of were like, hey, how can we do more with you? This was sweet. How can we help this, you know, how can we make it so you do 30 videos instead of 10? That kind of thing. So it's, I think that the cycling audience was sort of starved for content. It's hard to watch if you're into cycling. It's hard to watch the races in Europe. There's like, you've probably seen Dave like trying to find like live grainy live feeds online, and it's always cutting out. It's some like pirated feed from Belgium, and I think that a lot of cycling fans are sort of sick of the competition side of just, you know, the doping and all that stuff. Like when you watch it, like a lot of fans are just jaded with a lot of the big names now. And so it was sort of fortuitous timing for a loud, clean guy to just like have a blast riding his bike and make a show of it. And people sort of found it and enjoyed that part.
You seem like, you strike me as someone who's kind of pioneered their own path, because even before, or the way you got into cycling and just the drive to go as far as you did with it. Like, I guess I'm curious, like what has been driving you from the start of cycling and maybe even before that? Like,
that's part of the tricky thing is I was never driven for anything before I started riding a bike. I was kind of just like an average student in high school. Like I think I was smart, but I wasn't athletic. I didn't do anything. I was like kind of a dick to my teachers, one of those. Went to college and like kind of got into the cycling club there and made some friends, and riding a bike was, I just joined the club because I liked riding bikes. I didn't realize that like racing was a thing. Cycling club, their main thing was racing. So they're going to races, and it turned out like it was the first thing I ever felt like I was good at. And I found that at like 18 and a half. And then, and it was the first thing that like didn't feel like work. Like time just passed when I was riding. It's social and it's competitive. So it's been easy to sort of, it never felt like I was driving myself or like pushing against something. It was sort of, I don't know where I would have drive if I stopped riding the bike. So I'm still like, I'm finding that in other places in between, but all the other stuff I did on the side, all the like writing, and I had a business, like that all kind of steered towards making cycling work. Those were all like things I had to do in between, which for better or for worse.
So. Yeah, it kind of sounds like cycling like pulled you. Like, even as you were talking, I was like imagining like a current of like, it didn't even feel like you were creating it because it was kind of like pulling you along.
Right. The thing is, there was sort of like a desperation angle to all of it. There was always like I want to do this, but I don't want to do it the wrong way. And I don't want to like sacrifice everything for it. I know a lot of people who are kind of like victims of following their dreams or victims of professional cycling in a lot of ways. Like, I think people don't talk, this was like a big theme in my book is people don't talk about, they tell you to chase your dreams, but the people who tell you that, the people who get the microphone are the ones who achieve their dreams. Mm-hmm. And they don't give the microphone to the guys who got 80%, or I was a solid 98.5% of my dreams. And it's kind of like, it's real at the 98.5%, and you can throw away a decade if you're not careful, or more. So, and I know a lot of live in Hollywood, like there's a lot of those that come by the bus here. So I think I sort of feel like I'm kind of a cautionary tale in some ways, but out of that desperation, I've managed to like sort of piece things together. And I think once I gave up, it got a lot easier. I still feel like I'm in the process of like establishing that and what I'm doing with the next chapter.
It sounds like you were really intentional about like your cycling career, intentional about creating like a side business or multiple side businesses so that you could do what you wanted to do.
Yes and no. I think I was definitely intentional. I definitely like everything that I was doing was targeted toward one thing. I think I really failed in looking long-term enough. Like looking back, I kind of give myself some credit. I was forced to make short-term decisions, but I, like one example I think about a lot is my first professional team, and this was a small tier team, but it was Jelly Belly is the name of the team. And they were kind of like one of the better teams in the US as far as they got invited to the biggest races. And if you want to go to Europe, if you want to be one of the top guys, you have to do the most competitive races. You have to race against the European guys. But the tricky part was my salary on that team was $2,000 for the year. So I was on that team, and when they offered me a raise to $6,000, which is still not going to do it, I was like, well, I can't live on that. So my response was I switched teams. I found a team that paid me $15,000, and I started a business. And basically that was 3 years that kind of were thrown away from my cycling progress because I wasn't invited to big races. That team was, you know, I'm doing races that don't really suit me. I wasn't really getting better at the rate that I could have. And I don't know what I would have done had I stayed on Jelly Belly, but I feel like what I know now, I would have been in Europe a year sooner if I somehow found a way to be more targeted towards that and not like having a business. It made me enough money that I could train and live, but it also took time away from racing. Mm-hmm. Part of me wishes like, or thinks I could have somehow gone deeper or crashed on more sofas or figured it out for one more year. And that might've, you know, you go 8 years later and I'm long list for the Olympics, but not selected. And it's like, well, I missed it by not much. and you think about those little decisions, little forks in the road early on. So intentional, yes, but you know, hindsight is 2020. And I definitely could have, I feel like I could have done more of, okay, I'm here now. My goal is this. How do I get there? Like, okay, I'm here now. I have to get there right now.
Yeah. Looking longer term, right, for what the bigger picture goal is. Right. And then how can you make it work?
Yeah. Just looking at how it had been done historically probably would have been good for me rather than just like, I blazed my own trail more than necessary. So it got there, but you think about those things later when it comes down to the real minutia and the real, when it gets close.
Well, it kind of sounds like a little bit of fight or flight kicking in of like, I have to feed myself and I have to, you know, pay my bills and I have to have a place to live. So yeah, maybe some of that instinct was kicking in and causing you to not look at it as like, it was a great opportunity.
Right. Yeah. It was definitely that. And again, like when I look at those decisions, like I don't know what I would have done otherwise, which is why I made those decisions. Mm-hmm. But it's still they're like, I could have begged my parents to float me a year. Mm-hmm. I was privileged to start out, and like I had a bullheaded I will be independent thing. And ultimately, like I could have paid my parents back, especially the way I was living back then at 23, you know.
It wouldn't have been that much money.
No,
for them.
Small used car.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like, it sounds like there was a lot of learning for you there is a lot of learning for you as you reflect back on that experience. And what if anything is different now in how you go about making decisions?
Oh shit, that's a good question. I haven't asked myself that yet. There was definitely a lot of reflecting, and I think it's weird because I had a therapist for a couple of years, and she always advised you that you should journal. And it's like, who has freaking time for that? But then I got a book deal, which is essentially a giant journal, which totally forced me to reflect and analyze things. And I found that and now I'm advising people to journal, and they're going to say, well, who has time for that, Phil? That's a valid point. But I found when I was writing things down for a future audience, I found that I was explaining them and also understanding them for the first time myself. You think about like, oh, I want the, and it's like, oh, that's what I was doing. So yeah, it's definitely like a lot of reflection that was forced upon me, and not like something that I meditated. But what do I do? I guess I think about my decisions more now. I try to not be so desperate. But I also, maybe I trust my gut a little more because it's gotten me somewhere. But when my whole YouTube thing started, the way it happened was there was a guy who was caught doping, or he had been doping. I don't know, either he was doping or whatever, but he, at some point he had been doping, and he had all the little Hillkind records in LA. There's like an app that tracks all of them. And there's a very small category of people who spend a lot of time and a lot of energy and were really pissed at this one guy who at some point had been a doper, had every record in LA. I happened to live here, and once I was done racing, I was like, oh, what's this app that everybody who rides bikes is talking about? Like, pros don't pay attention to it. But I kind of went on there, and I was able to take all the doper records from this one guy. I was able to just go through I would do a rest day, and then I would go do a hill, and then I would take a day off. And I did that, and it got basically like, it revealed to me that I immediately got a big following on this app, and I realized like, okay, there are people who are very interested to see what a pro can do on their hills, you know. And I noticed, and it's very clear, like when I would post a picture of my face on Instagram, it would get 500 likes. When I would post a picture of myself getting a hill climb record from this doper, it would get 1,100 likes. And my thing was, okay, people.
Well, what created that urge within you to do that? Like, where did that come from?
Well, the first one was an accident, where I was just like on a group ride with my friends, and I think I was just curious what that app was. Like, I knew that I was done racing at that point. So this was like September 2016. So like, I don't have a contract for the next year. I'm still technically on the team and a professional cyclist through the end of the calendar year. So I have a few months where I'm like paid and I have nothing to do. So I was like job hunting, but I'm still going to ride my bike. And I was kind of looking for what's a competitive outlet that isn't a bike race. And that's what this app is for. It's called Strava. And basically you could just go and race your own self and do your PRs and race other people who've done the same climb. So I kind of thought like, this might be a way that when I'm stuck in an office in a year, I can go out and entertain myself and still have goals and still be fit and like a little motivation to ride the bike. But I saw a response to it, and by the end of the year, I kind of had sponsors I had a relationship with were like, hey, can we sponsor you for this? And I was like, I don't even know what this is. And that was when kind of the YouTube idea fell into place. I'd been trying to sell, I live in Hollywood, I've been trying to sell like a travel show to like traditional TV outlets. And I was banging my head against that wall. Same like pro cycling. I had a good idea, and I just wasn't able to fit in that system. And so I was like, well, if I get sponsors, I can just make a show myself. And completely ignorant of what it costs to make a show. Like, it was a horrible, the math on that wouldn't have worked out well. And just like how much work it is. I thought I could do it in my spare time. And because I thought I was going to have a 9-to-5. And I figured, oh, on weekends, I'll make a YouTube show. I'm like, no, that's full time. So the desk job sort of didn't pan out. And I had nothing to do but just like make this work.
Well, it sounds like there was an opportunity there that you capped. Like, you saw, and then you made it something more, like you built on it intentionally.
Right. I definitely saw like, okay, there's people who are super interested in this and no one else is doing it. And there's people who want me to get doper hill climb records, and there's no one else who can do it. Like, I know 50 guys in the world who can go fast enough to beat doper records on hill climbs, and those guys are all busy doing real bike races. So I have to be the guy who does this if anyone's going to do it. So I found something that I was uniquely qualified for, which was that. And then it kind of like fit with other stuff. So that's something that I've been trying to do too, is I guess think about things that, what can I do that nobody else can do? Like, what am I in a unique situation to make work? So I wrote a book, and you know, if you write a book and you have a YouTube channel, you can talk about one on the other. It sort of, it helps that. And then I started putting on this event, which is just basically like a marathon for bikes where you set a course and people come ride, because there isn't an event like that in LA. And I'm the only, well, I was the only like high level pro who lived in LA at the time. So sort of like all these things, like being out there in media and having an event and having like, they all sort of fit together, to where like, okay, somebody needs to put on a big bike ride in Malibu. And it's going to have to be me.
Well, it sounds like you really trust yourself and you trust like your ideas and maybe the gut sense that you're talking about. And I'm curious, like, do you have, because as you're talking, I'm thinking probably a lot of people might have those ideas and then have the next idea be, I could never do that, or I could not, you know, I could never make that work and I need to do the 9 to 5. Do you have those kinds of thoughts, or is it just like you get an idea and you're like, of course I'm the one to do this, and then you make it happen?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of me like really wants to play it safe all the time. I think part of me is like just a base level of horrified at everything that I do. I've definitely like been talked out of a lot of things. Like I'm lucky I've found some good people. Good people have found me in some cases and been like, that's not a good idea. Don't do that. Like I've almost started a lot of businesses. I would say I'm probably more confident in my ideas, and a lot of times like I get talked down from things, but I listen to that.
Is that something you've had like, you know, for a long time, or is it a new thing, like the confidence?
I think it's something that like I sort of learned when I had a business. So I had this when I left Jelly Belly, I started this like clothing company. And at first it was all my own, and it was kind of just, my idea was like, with it at the time, if you wanted to ride bikes, and the only spandex they were selling at bike shops was very plain designs, or like pro team stuff. And I remember like before I was on a team, I was like, well, I don't want to wear that because I'm not on that team. I don't want to pay to wear somebody else's logos. That's stupid. But I also don't want like a solid blue jersey, because that's also stupid. So I kind of had the idea of like, what if we put something cool on a bike jersey? And that was definitely something that like people wanted other than me. So I sort of like put myself in the shoes of my potential customer. And so from there, like I had some good ideas that made me trust myself more. I was like, oh, what if we make, you know, a suit that looks like Pee Wee Herman's outfit, and that like went viral, and everybody like, we sold a bunch of those. And I just like, I had a few of those, and I kind of built trust in myself. And eventually, like, I also totally missed the mark on the cycling fashion industry. Like, I was right that people didn't want to wear the pro team jerseys, but like now there's a million brands that are selling like cool designs and cool patterns. And like, I was just like putting a funny thing, like a t-shirt I was putting on a bike jersey. I thought that was it didn't occur to me to like, I can barely like put two colors together. But now like when you go to a bike shop, like there's flowers and there's patterns and there's shapes. And it's like, I was right about part of it, but I did it totally wrong. And some of those companies are getting, Rafa just sold for, I forget, like 100 million, like a lot. and mine kept me afloat at the time. But I still sort of trusted, like, okay, I saw something, I figured it out, and it worked.
Yeah, something worked.
Able to scale and take more risks like that. But I also like find people or look for people who know the business. And so for the event I put on, one of my best friends in my neighborhood puts on a bunch of events. Like that's his job. And if I didn't have access to him to sort of partner with and manage my event, I wouldn't be in a unique situation to make it work. You know, like if I had to hire an outside company, I would have been out of pocket tens of thousands of dollars the first year, and I don't have that deep of a pocket. But so sort of seeing like, okay, I know that guy, this would work here. And then like at that point, like I wasn't really afraid to jump on it.
Yeah. It's like you're trusting yourself and you're also asking for help at the same time. So I guess, you know, one of the purposes of this interview is to like talk to people who are using like their own kind of inner compass to guide them, like their gut sense or intuition, whatever you want to call it. And I guess I'm curious in what you're saying, because it seems like there's yes, this gut sense of an idea comes to you that you want to pursue. And then I'm also hearing that you have a good support, like network of people you can ask for kind of bounce things off. So how do you balance, like, and you said you've been talked down a few times, like on an idea you had. So how do you balance, like, if it's something that feels like your gut sense and like when to go further and push further, even if people think it's a silly idea?
Right. I think one thing that I definitely did well that I learned in cycling is when you're the shittiest guy on a big team, you quickly have access to people who know what the heck they're doing. And I remember when I got on Jelly Belly, I didn't know what I was doing, but I now have the access. I'm in a bus with 12 guys who do all year. And I kind of like grabbed hold of, at the time that was Jeremy Powers, who ended up being like national champion a bunch of times. But as far as just like, okay, this is a guy who has things figured out and has a name and has results and is a nice guy who's like, well, basically we became friends, but he was someone who like, okay, he gets it. And I'm just going to hold on to him as long as he doesn't swap me away. And then, so he was sort of someone that I still call for advice, often. And then in LA, I kind of met, there's part of what's great about, well, the, one of the better things about living here is there's just so many cool people. And because I was good enough on a bike, I was able to sort of get access to dudes who ride their bike in LA, who are Hollywood agents and sports agents and business people and all kinds of just like successful, impressive human beings, who are like, oh, cool, we get to ride with Phil. And I'm like, fuck, I get to ride with this guy. And he's like, on the Food Network selling cookies, and so one of my best friends is Jeff Mahan, who's like he's a chef and he makes all the cookies for my event. So one guy that I met on basically on a group ride in LA was a sports agent, and so he's also like, you know, a good business brain and a bunch of contacts and someone that like I've bounced a million ideas off of, and usually he just smacks them down. Or he says like, that one has legs, like, let's see who we can call, who might know what they're doing. So doing homework before I jump into something is something that I've for sure learned.
How do you balance, like, and I may struggle to put this into words, but it seems like there, you know, there's a way that you can be where you can just like let somebody else direct the way you should go and let them tell you what to do, and it kind of like losing yourself in the process, like not really having a voice or being in alignment with like what's true for you, like in your gut. So how have you balanced or found your way with like my impression of our interactions is you're very like bold would be a word, and straightforward and direct. Like you don't hold back. I don't get the sense that you hold back like who you are. And so how have you found like that balance of bringing yourself to the relationship and also yielding and listening to other people's advice and experience? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think just knowing empirically that like a lot of people who are just more successful than me or who they are where I want to be in some capacity, and it just makes obvious sense to listen to those people. I guess to me that's super obvious. to some people, like a lot of people give me advice on riding a bike, and it's like, you're never going to do anything because you should be asking me questions. To me, that's how it should work, clearly. But I think, yeah, maybe that's unique and that helps. But so I have ideas and I trust my ideas, and I sometimes I argue, and sometimes like my former agent would say, no, don't start that stupid business, and I'd be like, oh, I think he's wrong, and I'm pissed about it, but I would listen. And yeah, or like I would know, like, well, I can't come to him ever again for this whole sort of way that.
When do you like fight for something in terms of like you really feel like it's worth pursuing, even because I'm imagining based on what you've told me, there's things that maybe people shot down and you like continued to go for, and maybe not, maybe that's not the case.
Well, that was like, I feel like that was my entire racing career was I deep down, like I would have little moments every year in a bike race that like convinced me that I was good enough to go to the next level, to do something. And then it was kind of a matter of getting my foot in the door, convincing someone else of it. And generally like that took 2 years longer than I wanted it to. But there was always like part of me like, okay, you should quit. This is a stupid thing. You're not getting paid enough and this is dangerous. And this is the level you're at. You're 25 and you're living out of your car. But then it was like, okay, like I came this close to winning this race and nobody else saw it, or like the best guys in the world were racing up this mountain. And I missed that front group by 10 feet and I was right there and I was 23 and it's like, okay, that's not fake. And I know I can do better than I am. And so I'm just going to keep banging my head against this wall. But then at some point I sort of saw like, okay, like my head got through the wall. Like it's enough banging. And there was a moment, well, there were a few moments when I finally like got to Europe. And I'm with the best guys in the world. It's like, oh, I'm never going to get there. Like you can see the difference at that point. It's like, okay, I'm not at my ceiling, but I'm damn close. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of liberating. And I've sort of looked for other scenarios like that, where I know that there are limits to everything. And I don't have the capacity to screw up a bunch of times, to get it right. So
yeah, it sounds like you kind of like that before getting to Europe, you just had this sense that you could do it even if other people didn't see it. And then once you got to Europe, you kind of realized, okay, I think I'm maxed out here. Yeah.
My thing was, and this is kind of what I said about not looking far enough ahead, was I would always look at the next step and not the top of the steps. And I don't know if that's good or bad. So I'll see people who like just started riding and they'll be like, I want to be a pro. And I'm like, well, maybe you should try to be a category 4. Maybe that's the thing that makes sense for you because you're skipping 9 steps to be a pro. I think that's valid advice when I make it to people, but I think it's also because I didn't think that way, it cost me. And that probably applies to other things that hopefully I'm not still doing.
I'm wondering what would the 10 steps ahead right now for you be?
I don't know. I think now part of it is just like not attempting anything that's so ridiculously lofty, or not like entering into a thing that has a tiny chance of positive outcome. Because what I eventually realized is like, okay, pro cycling, you can be really freaking good, and it's just like not a great life, and you're kind of at someone else's mercy all the time. Like I wasn't quite good enough to enjoy it. Whereas, you know, with an event and a YouTube channel, and it's more my say over my time, and I'm kind of in control over who my sponsors are and what they want with me, I can do less of what I don't want, to go full circle with that. And I can do, so right now, if this situation is status quo and I can keep that rolling, I would feel successful and happy. I don't need to be one level up at all times to be. So like if whatever National Geographic called and said, hey, we want to make your YouTube travel show on our thing, I'd be like, cool, but I don't need it.
What is that like for you to not need something else?
It's a big relief. I'm still getting used to it. Like I still want to do 20% more than I have time for. I still like say yes to too many things, and I have a spreadsheet full of YouTube videos that I don't have, that I can't hire someone to make with me, that I don't have like enough budget to get the film guy. There's a lot of Strava KOMs, they're called, of the hill climb records that like, oh man, that would be a super cool one to go film and ride. It's like, I can't get there. Like, I don't know when I could get there. There's a to-do list on my phone that's very bizarre. And it's just like, these are the climbs that I want to go faster up than anyone else before I start to get weaker and older. So all I can do is kind of just peck away at it. But overall, it's a nice feeling. Kind of, I kind of feel like a pirate. Like I have this little thing and little arms of it, and it works. And no one can really bother me at this point. But they do. I still get plenty annoyed.
Well, it sounds like you've really created what you want.
Yeah, for right now, I have. But I guess this isn't a surprise. Is like, you still make struggles that feel exactly the same, you know, like just like when you win the lottery, you're back to your base, whatever level of happiness they say. And I forget how many months, but I have to force myself to zoom out a lot and be like, oh, okay, you can't really be mad about this, 'cause this is fine. But I can have like a sponsor who's mad about something or who's asking too much or whatever. Like I can get myself into a mood and forget that things are going fine. Part of that is maybe I just need to be used to things being fine. Yeah. But lately when a friend asks, like if somebody I haven't talked to in a while and they ask how I'm doing, I say I'm good. And like, I never said that. Like, I didn't say that until I was 31, 32. I never felt like things were going well, until I stopped trying to be someone else's definition of well, I guess. But yeah, overall, I feel like I was struggling for most of that.
Like you were trying to reach something that wasn't really what you wanted?
Well, the thing is, like, a YouTube channel wasn't an option in 2009, I didn't know what it was, but yeah, I think the... Any like ladder in sports, it's a very direct ladder, and that probably applies to corporate ladders too. Is like, in my case, it was kind of false. You know, like the concept of a ladder, when what you need to do is sort of find the ladder, find the rung that works for you, and make it work for you, in other ways, and that might just be like a puzzle that we play with our whole lives, right?
Yes, and I also am hearing that it seems like you found the rung that's working for you.
Yeah, I think that until someone who's faster than me decides to be competitive at Strava, which I think it's going to be a while, and someone who like knows how to make videos, I found like enough skills that I've figured out that I'm just getting better at that. That hopefully I could just keep balancing those and kind of just making fun stuff. And ultimately, yeah, I was trying to make a travel show, or I was trying to make someone else make it for me. And before I convinced them to do it, I just found a way to make it myself. And that was just pecking away at it, I guess.
So just to summarize, what I'm hearing you say is that success to you is doing more of what you love, more of what you want to be doing, and less of what you don't like. And what you love, it sounds like, is riding bikes.
Yeah, for some reason, like I really like flogging myself up hills, and it's I'm really good at it, and it's pretty pointless, but I've kind of found a way to like tell stories around it and make it interesting to people. I think the best compliment I got, because when you watch a bike race, like the mountaintop stages are the most boring part, because it's just like dudes riding 8 miles an hour up a hill, and usually they just get farther and farther away from each other, and it's not. And someone commented on my YouTube that Phil makes riding a bike uphill entertaining, and that was like, yes.
You're like, I've made it.
Yeah, if that works, if someone else that occurred to them, then that's a feat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've achieved success.
Yeah, and I think part of it, when there's sort of like a flawed concept in, maybe it's all pro sports, but in pro cycling, it's very clear, like, okay, these are the sponsors of this team. So the riders on this team are all paid to say, like, this is my favorite bicycle. And no one really believes them, because it's obviously not sincere. It's the situation that they're in. And so like they end up on the catalog for the bike brand. But as far as like when I stopped, like I was kind of the person with undoubtable expertise who actually could say whatever I wanted and pick sponsors for the most part. Like, it's not like they were all banging down my door, but a lot of them were. And I could sort of pick and choose, like, this is the clothing brand that I selected, and here's why. And it might not be because their clothing is a bad example, because the clothing is good quality, but I'm not saying this clothing brand is better than the other one, but like, as far as they're a better fit for who I am, and here's why. Like, Castelli is my clothing sponsor, and when I told them about it, they were like, this is cool, we want to help you make this. So like, as a company, they were into the weird shit I was doing, which I didn't know what it was, but they wanted to help me make it happen. And kind of like their creative people kind of helped me steer and create it. So to me, like, that's a sincere message that I have when for any product on my bike and anything that I kind of endorse, when pro cycling has a credibility problem anyway, thanks to doping. and it's gotten more so. So I'm someone who, like, I never doped and I was loud about that. And now, like, I'm not tied to these teams controlling my sponsors. So the credibility issue doesn't apply to me or my show, which I guess is also a gap that needed to be filled, the cycling community.
So what makes you unique?
I would say like a combination of, like, I'm stubborn, and like, I know that I'm smart and I can ride a bike fast, and I think like, and I will outwork people if I feel like it makes sense to. I can be stubborn, but like, there was a point when like it made no sense to keep racing, and I was 23 and I was like, F this, I can do this thing that. And it's not like anybody bothered to tell me I couldn't, like, I wasn't even worth them saying, like, dude, give up. I wasn't relevant. But I kind of like forced myself into that. I would just say, like, I have a weird combination of abilities, and I've kind of found ways to put them together, into one thing. Like, I don't know, lots of pro cyclists are funny and can work. I don't know a lot who would bother to sit down and write a book. I'll be that guy. Like, those guys can all drop me in the bike race. I'll be the one who like trains really hard, and then I'll sit in my apartment and type for 4 hours. I don't know. I guess they're getting massages.
Well, it's like you're filling in the gaps.
Sort of, yeah. And I always felt like I had something to say. Like, that's probably, and that goes to just like being a kid, like, and getting in trouble in school. Like, I'd be the smart aleck, and that now that applies to Twitter. Like, you can, being a smart aleck wasn't useful when I was 11. But now it's like, people can be entertained by it.
So what's next for you?
And I don't know. I think, I think I have ideas to make the YouTube show better. One of the things that's sort of looming over year one was the whole idea of, because it started by beating dopers. It had sort of a negative connotation. It had a like, there was a, which, and it was tongue in cheek, but it still existed. And people, like, my entire year, and I still get this, but people were like, you've got to, like, this doper has this hill climb record. You got to go take it and bring it back to the people. And like, I don't, A, like, that's just like a difficult thing to get people to sponsor because it's a little bit grumpy. Even though it's funny, it's still like, it put me on the map, but it's also not something I want to be doing in 10 years. And also, like, the level of fitness required, it was easy to do that when I was coming off of international level stuff. It's much harder to just like go train and get that fast. Like, the way that you get fast is you do 7-day stage races, you know, week on, week off for a spring, and you coast on that. And you can't really simulate that. So like, I can train hard and I can be a level of fitness that's relevant, but I can't be what I was. So I guess my knowing those two things, what my plans is to, I'm transitioning the YouTube show from, it used to be called Worst Retirement Ever. So the joke there was that I'm so bad at retiring that I'm still training hard. And now I'm flipping it to Best Retirement Ever, which is where I'm riding my bike in cool places and I'm exploring and I'm ripping up a whatever hill, whether it's a doper or not, I'm doing it because I love it, which is totally true. And I don't want to be limited to just climbs. Like, dopers already defined my whole racing career because they were there the whole time and they were scaring the sponsors away. And I'm not going to let them define my post-career YouTube show either. So I'm just going to go up the hills that I think are cool, and I'm going to go to places that are fun to me. And I think that story will speak to people as well. But, and it's something that, like, I could be doing that in 10 years if I don't have to beat, Tom Danielson's record up Mount Lemmon, like, mm-hmm. that. I can, this is a sustainable thing that's fun and that's positive and that I think people can get behind. And hopefully I think people who want to watch people, I think people want to watch someone riding a bike and exploring as much as they want to watch people competing at it, or it's a different audience, or it's growing, or it's a Venn diagram, but, remains to be seen. But it's still an experiment. It's still like reinventing myself and trying something different and crossing my fingers that they come along.
Which it seems like that's happening. Like, and even just hearing your story, the impact that it's having on me is like, I'm wanting to follow you and I don't even ride bikes.
That's, if I can get people who don't ride bikes to watch me riding bikes, that's when it's next level.
But yeah.
Or like the interesting thing about YouTube is like people comment and it's infuriating because it's criticism when it's like, man, I just made this for you for free and it took me a month to make this thing. But also like you can respond to it. And that's kind of whereas in Hollywood or whatever, you're locked into X episodes or there's a lot of cooks and in the kitchen. Whereas this is kind of like, okay, I can pivot, I can respond, I can evolve. And every show could be different. And yeah, so it's fun to kind of like involve people in it. Like I can have them vote on the way the model is, they vote on my Facebook page of where I go. The viewers kind of have like an ownership of it. And it's all like part of the whole process.
Yeah. They're like kind of fueling you along and like, the engagement with them is helping you to direct how to take it, how to navigate it.
Like when I was racing, like I was good, but in Europe, like I'm just a guy in a pack, and like I wasn't entertaining anyone. Like I had no impact on anyone's life, but like maybe my teammates and whatever. But no one was like, oh, I got to watch Phil in this bike race. Like they're looking at a pack of dudes, and maybe they're trying to pick me out if they know me. But now it's kind of like people are watching me, and that's nice. Like that sort of feel like there's and they're discussing it, and it feels like. And people said, dude, your last show was really funny. It's like, that feels good. I made people laugh. Like that's an achievement that kind of feels better than if I won a bike race back in the day, it's kind of like, okay, that was cool, but what was that for? You know, like, you get congratulations, you don't get thank yous. I think at some point, like, the thank yous feel better.
But it also feels like it's more than entertainment. Like, I get the sense from you that this bike, like, this thing is more than biking. Like, there's something that's really important about it to you.
Yeah, I think, I guess from knowing my experience of when I started riding a bike, where, like, I was fat, I never had a girlfriend, I wasn't happy, I was like, you know, I was depressed in high school. And then when I started riding, it kind of opened up a whole new world of a way to see the world and a way to be fit and being outside. And I assume that it wouldn't have that same effect on everybody, but I know what it did for me. And I'm sure that there are other people out there, like, somewhere there's me at 16 who didn't happen to have a bicycle to ride to school or whatever. It didn't occur to him to ride his bike to class. And maybe that helps someone else, or it has that impact. But for me, it's just knowing how it worked for me, like, expressing that and expressing, like, the thing that I love doing, it feels good. I mean, it is genuine.
Yeah, it's exactly like, I guess I didn't even know why I wanted to interview you, and you just said exactly why I wanted to interview you, because it's, and I didn't even know this about you, but it's like helping people see something else possible through you being like a vehicle to show them something new.
Right. And it might be like a logical fallacy, because I compare it, well, just right now I'm comparing it to, like, I've met people who were fat, lazy slobs who went vegan, and then they got fit and now they're doing triathlons or something, and they want everyone to go vegan. And there is a logical thing to that. There is a A to B that makes sense to them. And when they say everyone should go vegan, they're sincere. And, like, part of me finds them annoying. So it's like, that worked for you and it didn't work. It wouldn't necessarily work for everybody else. And maybe it's also because you just started thinking about what you put in your body for the first time in your life. And you could have just stopped eating, you know, McDonald's every day and had healthy meat. You know what I mean? So, like, there's definitely, riding bikes isn't everyone's answer, but it's my story. And I think it definitely speaks to enough people that, there has to be something to it. And I think a lot of folks can kind of, like, identify with me failing to get a hill climb record or just riding somewhere and enjoying it.
Well, and it's like I'm inspired just hearing you, and it's something about the energy that's behind what, like, that's driving what you're doing, that's inspiring. Even if it's not biking that does it for them, it's like, I guess what's landing for me is, like, being passionate about what you're doing, right, and, like, being all in and trying to make something of it. Like, you're not settling. You're not giving up because the first thing doesn't work or the second thing doesn't work. You're, like, committed to, like, your own happiness is what it sounds like.
Yeah. And I don't think anything ever feels like it works, but I think you can make it work enough. That's kind of something I figured out, like, from the clothing business to whatever else, like, nothing got to the level that I wanted it to, or that I thought it would after X years. Like, my books didn't sell as many copies as I hoped, like nothing, like, but it's all, like, it's all good enough. And I can give myself, like, yeah, it's okay. And I guess that started with my racing career too. I learned everything from racing, and then I've applied it. But I remember, like, when I was racing, I was always like, you know, you win a medal, you win a jersey. If you win a bike race, they give you, like, a jersey as a prize. And I would all, like, by the time I got it, I was always like, I got to get this next one now. And so I never, like, they ended up in a box in my mom's house that it was in my old closet in the room I grew up. And when I retired, at some point, like, I was in my mom's house and I found this box And in some ways, just this massive box full of jerseys and medals that are just crumbled up. And I was like, oh, I'm done racing. Like, I should hang these up and convince myself to be proud of it. and when they're all up in the garage, it's kind of I was never happy about my career, but I looked at it like, that's pretty good. That's good enough. And it's going to have to be good enough. But part of it, there was sort of a process of intentionally convincing myself that this is good. I won last year. They kind of had a new event that USA Cycling put on called Hill Climb National Championships. And because it was his second year, no pros really attended, and I knew I could win. So I went and I won it. But it didn't feel like a huge achievement because I know it wasn't that competitive, and I know 50 guys who would have beat me if they'd bothered to show up. But I hung that jersey on the wall. I got it framed. It's a national championship, and I'm I'm going to be proud of this. and eventually I was, and it's a thing that matters to me. So maybe there's a balance there too of just stepping back and being and forcing yourself to be happy in the situation that's your best.
Yeah. And it also sounds like you see, I don't want to say it's a high standard that you have. I mean, maybe that's what it is, but I'm also hearing you see really far for yourself, and then maybe you don't achieve that right. final goal that you see, but you go a lot further than you would have if you hadn't had set that goal for yourself.
Right. That's kind of a disease, I feel like. I talk about this in the book too, but I guess there are people who don't have to try to be the best at something. And I'm jealous of that because I want more. I'm accomplishment greedy or something. Achievement greedy. I don't know what it is, but it's rare for me to be satisfied with what I have and not thinking about the next thing. And I think that's made things difficult, but it's also I guess it makes you push yourself. I guess that's just different kinds of personalities, right?
And it doesn't, I don't know, the way you're describing it, it doesn't feel a achievement so much as it feels that you're capable of more.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think for whatever reason, I'm not that interested in something that I know I can do. That's not that cool. But it's cool to think what else can I do? Mm-hmm. What experiences can I collect? And what things can I sort of if it's all just a puzzle, how can we fit things together in a way that your life is a work of art? That sounds mm-hmm. super cool. But that.
Yeah. It's you strike me as someone that would not be happy if you were just going through the motions. You really thrive off of being, of stretching yourself and going further than at least going for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so. But then there's still a part of me that craves going through the motions that the security and something that was simple that I could turn off. Cause I still I don't have a 9-to-5 job. It's all the time. And then it's just different jobs. So it's and part of this has always worked for me too, I learned this from racing in college, but you work one system. So I go train, and then I go home and I would do homework. And I took that to racing, right? I go race and then I'm back at the hotel and I could write. So I'm always working on a different system at once, a different category. Physically I have to rest, but mentally now I can exercise and sort of just bouncing between those has kind of given me time to keep pushing it, whatever else I'm doing. Yeah. So different, that's advice I've given people is categorize things you're working on and that don't really conflict with each other. So have a physical goal, and then on your rest days, have a mental goal, and don't waste your time.
Yeah. Using different muscles. So final question. I have a sense that you can already see like the far out goal for yourself. Like, I feel like the ones that you told me were like the short term goals, like with the YouTube. So I guess what is your far out goal right now that you see for yourself?
I honestly don't. I think that YouTube is going to grow. I feel like Hollywood is going to hurt, and pro cycling it continues to like kick itself in the shin. And I think like if I keep making what I make and keep responding to the audience, I think I'm ahead of something. I don't know what, but I feel like I can ride this wave and basically like for me, the success now would be to like make what I'm doing feel secure and sustainable. Which I've never really felt in my life. It's like right now I have like all my contracts are for 1 year and all my sponsors are happy, but it's still like, I don't have the volume of sponsors to feel like if one of them goes out of business, I'm in trouble. You know, like if one changes their marketing strategy, I can't afford to do this part now. But I think, you know, maybe the event makes up for it and I could just put energy into things that feel safe. I want to grow my event. I want everyone to, one thing that was cool is I don't know why I did it the first year. I think I just saw that like no one knows how nice the riding is in LA. And I wanted to sort of like share that. I want to say like, this is how cool it is to ride here. So like, come here, I'll show you. So I think doing that is, and at the end of that, it was, I'm suddenly like, I'm in a room and there's 1,000 people who are walking by smiling, eating cookies that my friend made for them. And they're saying like, thank you, this was a great day. And I was surprised that I was like touched by how many people were like, I mean, like, I guess of course, but that wasn't, I don't know what my goal was, but that was like, oh shit, that feels awesome. When like everyone walks by and like, thanks you and says like, hey, this was fun. And I think I can make more of that. I think I can make more fun stuff to share with people and that like lets me pay my bills and yeah, everybody's happy.
Yeah. And do what you love.
We partnered with a charity for my event. And then I've sort of been talking about that with my other stuff. It's Chef Cycle is kind of the vehicle for it. So it's a handful of celebrity chefs who I've made friends with a few of them now, and they do a ride. We have an East Coast ride and a West Coast ride, but they raise money for No Kid Hungry as the actual charity, which is exactly what it sounds like. They raise money. They do like education. They partner with schools, and basically like breakfast programs at needy schools and that kind of thing. Yesterday we did like a school visit, which it was the first thing I sort of directly seen. We went to a school in a less wealthy part of the city, and there's like a bunch of kids eating breakfast, and like part of my event, like we raised $20,000 for No Kid Hungry, and they turn every dollar they turn into 10 meals. And it's like, there's kids eating because of a thing I did with a bike. And that's kind of special and cool. And like, yeah, that felt good. I think I like, giving is nice. Like I like being able to like, once I make a living, like transitioning into giving is really the only success at that point. Like I don't need to collect things. Like I would like a nicer house, but for the most part, like that's the things that feel good are the smiles, people's faces and the emails saying like, hey, thanks for the podcast you make. And kind of thing. I think like collecting that has been really nice, and it's something to pursue as long as the world lets me.
Well, I'm appreciating being on the receiving end of you giving to me today of your time and doing this. I can tell you really like giving back is meaningful to you.
Yeah, I mean obviously it is to you too. You're dedicating yourself to that. And I think yeah, if you can find more people who have other unique messages, you're doing something great.
Yeah. Thank you for being willing to play and, just going with it.
No, you steered it. It was good.
Okay, well, I'll be in touch. And if there's anything I can do to support you, like, reach out to me. I'm happy to help.
Sure, all good. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
All right, I'll talk to you later. Okay, that's it for today's episode. Thank you for listening to Coaching with Catherine. If you like this podcast, please show us your support by leaving a review in iTunes or Google Play. It helps us so much and helps others to find the show. You can also visit me at www.coachingwithcatherine, spelled K-A-T-H-A-R-I-N-E.com, or on Facebook to learn more about me and the work I do. Thank you so much, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.